Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
Now, my next guest is familiar to listeners of The Hard Shoulder and indeed Taking Stock. He's also a former presenter of this show, Down to Business. He's also, something you didn't know about him, he's an esteemed author. Great pleasure to welcome to the programme, colleague here at the station, Mr. Emmett Oliver. How are you, Emmett?
Hi, Bobby. Thanks for mentioning all those various programmes I've hosted over the years, aging me straight away, but go on.
Good man. We're here to talk about your new book, Emmett, which is Irish Nation Building, Government, Business and Power between 1922 and 1958. And if we maybe just pause there for a second and think about, I suppose, the business landscape between those three odd decades when we got our independence from the Crown, so to speak, and the decades that followed, looking at it through a prism of business, what were the highlights?
Yeah, I mean, I've been writing about the Irish economy and business for a long time, but I didn't know as much about the early decades and why everything looks today, where it's come from and its antecedents. So I did some, I did my PhD in Trinity College Business School, just to mention there. And I was looking at various industries, the vital industries, insurance, transport, the railways, which are massive, and of course the banks. So when Ireland got its independence, what people may not realise listening in is how big agriculture was as part of the economy. Over 50% of the entire workforce were farming, fishing, something in that area. And here's, I found this amazing statistic, and it may be just me who finds this amazing, but we were the biggest exporter of cattle in the world.
Yeah.
So bigger than France, America, Argentina. So every day, and people listening in of a more mature age group will remember all these cattle going down the docks, out onto the boats to Liverpool, Glasgow, and that was the Irish economy. But unfortunately, when we got our independence from Britain, even that part of the economy was starting to trail away. Other countries, Denmark in particular, which is an important name in this story, were actually doing better in eggs, bacon, butter, those areas where Ireland had a traditional advantage. So when all these politicians came in the 20s and 30s and even beyond that, they had to really reinvent the Irish economy, start a whole new model. And they don't get necessarily much credit for having to do that. It's kind of ancient history now, but we had to go from that sort of production, primary product production model into what we have today, which is a services economy, obviously with the...
And when you think back to that, you know, that prominence of agriculture, that also tells you a whole lot of other things, that not so many people would have been living in Dublin, for instance, that the nation, the geographic spread of people. You mentioned the railways there. When we think about the railways, a big part of their role in those days, as you say, was bringing the cattle from various parts of Ireland to Dublin to be exported. And also, there was a passenger network that one may have questioned when you look at railway stations to places, you know, in the very outer regions. But we effectively ripped up the tracks, did we not?
Yeah, later on,
in the 50s, which seems like...
The CIE did that. Now railways, of course, are all in vogue because of climate change, and we want more railways. We, of course, ripped up the unfortunate trams here in Dublin, and decades later, the Lewis went on to exactly the same areas, are certainly part of the network. So it is very hard. Obviously, these politicians didn't know what was going to come later, and the problem for them was when they looked around at the world, Ireland didn't borrow externally, so the only people who could give you money then were the Irish banks. And the Irish banks had all their money in the UK in sterling assets. So they were effectively saying, why would we switch out of that market, which is very liquid, you can come and go and it holds its value, into a very unreliable Irish market give lending opportunities to the Irish government. So there was this big clash, particularly in the 50s, where the Irish banks stopped funding the Irish government entirely. They just had a kind of what they call a strike, you know, they just didn't give them the money anymore. Eventually it got solved. It was only a short-term thing, but it showed that the whole system had creaked. But when you talk about the railways, the fascinating thing that I found out as I was researching this area was in the 1930s, what we call the bondholders were burnt. Do you remember that whole period in the recent financial crisis? So these railway companies, of which there was well over 20 plus railway companies, they all had bonds that they'd raised. But because the car had come in, these railways were not as profitable. Their route networks were falling away. So they were over indebted. So somebody had to go along and burn the bondholders. And the man who did it was Sean Lamass. And some of these shares were written down in value by 90%. And it was a very bold thing that Lamass Hamas did. But guess who was not happy about this? The Financial Times in London wrote an editorial saying this was an abrogation of the rights of property owners and was totally unacceptable and was indefensible, was how they described it. So we found ourselves suddenly, you know, clashing with the old sort of City of London.
And isn't it amazing when you say there that, you know, the railways' woes were brought about by the car. The railways themselves destroyed the canal trade, which came before that.
So effectively you had canals replaced by railroad, and then railroad replaced by car, and then car in some ways replaced by the internet. And in other words, you can order your goods online now through the Amazon delivery man and not have to go and get them yourself. So each time a generation comes, a new technology comes along.
You mentioned insurance, and I don't know why that's one of your categories. Was that a kind of a Lloyd's thing that was an old Anglo-Irish thing?
Insurance, the interesting thing about that, and this is, again, slightly strange, but after 1916, all the main actors in that drama, Michael Collins included, were sent to a prison camp in Wales.
Francock.
Yes, exactly. And they were discussing their insurance, of all things, and they identified as the loss of money coming out of the country in insurance premiums, leaving Ireland and going out of the country to be, you know, recycled elsewhere. So they pledged at that stage to set up an insurance company, and that became New Ireland Assurance, which we have to this day. So effectively, they thought insurance was really important to keep that money in Ireland, recirculated here in the country. So they set up New Ireland. And then in the 30s, Lammas, again, a radical minister, like his name will crop up a lot in this book and in our conversation, he effectively nationalised a big part of the life assurance business, which at that stage was very large, again, and set up what is effectively today Irish Life. So all these companies that have offices not too far from us here all grow out of this period, this sort of a nationalistic period.
Shipping is another topic of conversation. And as an island nation, shipping has always had to be important to us, both for importing of goods. And again, you know, before flying was affordable to everybody, you know, the importance of the ferries connecting us to the UK were huge.
Yeah, and I mean, what I also found in this research, I got my hand on a timetable from the 30s of where all these ships were going. These are effectively cargo ships. Sometimes they take passengers too. And they were, of course, they were going to the Liverpools and Glasgow's on the West Coast, but they also went to London. So you could get on a freight, you could put your freight onto a ship going out of Dublin docks and headed off to London because, of course, there was no planes. So they were the sort of the Ryanair of their time. But the problem for the Irish shipping industry, Bobby, was Britain was so powerful in that area. It was the biggest builder of ships in the world. It had a huge capital market in London. So it was very difficult for the Irish shipping industry to kind of develop. We didn't really have a naval marine to protect us, a naval force to protect us.
Some might say we still don't.
Yeah, so that issue is still out there. So we do have, of course, Irish shipping grows out of the Second World War. So we have a state company. And today you have, obviously, Eamon Rothwell and Irish Continental Group and all those kind of companies, Irish Ferries and so on. But yeah, we really haven't, I don't know what you think, but we've never really quite cracked the shipping thing. We've never developed an international shipping industry. And if you read my account of it, I sort of say it's because you needed to put a lot of capital into it and stick with it for a long time. And I just don't think any government has had the kind of staying power to keep going with it. You know?
And the government had some huge problems with BNI and all that.
It
later
didn't work out for other reasons that we had a lot of time.
What are the learnings from this, Emmett, when we look back, and maybe we look back at these 3-odd decades and we look at business today, what are the key learnings here?
Yeah, well, for me, the key one is who runs Irish business? Who are the elites, the sort of power brokers of the area? And in these early decades, the Anglo-Irish, who were generally Protestant, controlled a lot of the big businesses, you know, from Guinness to Jacobs. All those companies were Protestant businesses.
The Quakers would have had a hand in there.
And then you had Stokes Kennedy Crowley, a name that a lot of people listening will remember. They became KPMG. The Stokes part was the Protestant Quaker part. The Crowley was the Catholic part. So the first elite were the Anglo-Irish. They kind of got pushed aside a little bit. In came more the Catholic population running Irish domestic businesses. But have they been displaced by the multinationals in recent decades? I finished the book by saying, who has that structural sort of power in the economy now? We can see from what's going on with Trump and the tariffs, just to bring you straight up to date today, even though I don't cover this, but you can see that the multinationals now seem to exert, because of the amount of their size of their capital and the employment that they can provide, they seem to be the winners of today, but what the next chapter is going to be, we don't really know.
Yeah, and I suppose finally then, it really does show that we were an island nation and, you know, we had tenuous links to the rest of Europe. Now our links are so much more solidified, so much more instant, so much more accessible.
What people probably would be surprised to hear is when we first started forging links with the American companies, Sean Lamass was saying, we don't really need to do that because we have the UK market. Our sort of, whether we like them or not like them, the UK market is where we're at. If you said that today, of course, people would laugh at you. We were less dependent on the UK. So, but did we swap one dependence, the UK, for another one with the US?
I think we might have done.
Maybe we need to spread our eggs even further in the basket in the future years.
All right, well, it's a great read. Irish nation building, government, business and power between 1922 and 1958. A historical look back at business by our own Emmett Oliver. Thanks, Emmett.
Thanks, Bobby.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.